Welcome. Today is Thursday, March 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, worrisome reports about what North Korea might be up to, despite just meeting with the U.S. president.
And what we saw was a rebuilding of an engine test stand and some activity at the launch pad at the Sohae test facility.
The White House pushes back on Congress's requests for documents. The president's trade war seems to be having an impact not the way it was intended. Also ahead, could researchers have found a cure for AIDS? It's all on today's International Edition. Multiple sources are reporting that North Korea has restored part of a missile launch site it began to dismantle after pledging to do so at the Singapore summit with U.S. President Donald Trump last year. The Center for Strategic and International Studies also concludes North Korea is pursuing a rapid rebuilding. VOA Asia's Ira Melman earlier talked about what this could mean with Lisa Collins, fellow with the Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She's part of the team that identified the photos that shows the changes at the Tongchang-ri launch site. Melman asks what the team saw from the photos.
So we identified them in imagery from March 2nd, and what we saw was a rebuilding of an engine test stand and some activity at the launch pad at the Sohae test facility.
And what did that mean to you?
I think what this means is that North Korea could be preparing to use this facility again, either that or they're trying to send a message to the United States about restoring this facility because of what happened in the negotiations last week.
Is, in your mind, a direct reaction to what happened? And what are you thinking so far? Is it that they're going to test again, or is it that it's just sending a message?
I think it's primarily sending a message. It's difficult to tell just by this one imagery shot whether or not North Korea was rebuilding the facility beforehand or during the summit or even afterwards. I think what it probably is just a symbolic message to the U.S. government that the North Koreans are still, you know, working on their WMD program and they won't give up what they have currently until there's significant economic relief in the form of sanctions relief.
And so far, the U.S. government, especially John Bolton, in a few TV appearances yesterday, said that's not going to be the case. In fact, it could go the other way, correct?
Correct, yes. Bolton did say that if North Korea doesn't start to show real significant signs of dismantling their nuclear weapons program, there could be an increase in sanctions from the United States.
I'd like to know where this puts, number one, the United States, number two, North Korea, and number three, especially South Korea, because it was to the South Korean President Moon that Kim Jong-un promised to dismantle this facility. Is that correct?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly. I think if North Korea is sending a message with this rebuilding activity, it could be the stick that they're trying to use to build greater leverage. They have, of course, continued to talk nicely about President Trump and about the aftermath of the summit in their state media. So they could be using a stick and carrot sort of strategy to get what they want out of the United States. So depending on whether or not that really, produces results, we just don't know yet.
The North Korean economy is not doing well. I've seen reports of famine rising its head again in North Korea, or maybe continuing to do that with all the money they're spending on their nuclear program. Is that correct?
Correct. North Korea has persistent problems with malnutrition and hunger and productivity in agriculture year to year. They have a hard time saving all of the harvest collected each year because of the weather and whatnot, and then because of state policies. But the North Korea economy is not doing very well right now. Some attribute that to sanctions pressure, and then some also attribute it to just the failed state policies on the economy.
What about South Korea? Does this put them in a bad position?
Yes, if the negotiations between the United States and North Korea fall apart completely after Hanoi, the South Koreans will be in a very difficult position. The current South Korean government, led by Moon Jae-in, they have tried very hard to engage the North Koreans. President Moon has staked a lot of political capital on engagement with North Korea. And so if this turns out to be a failure, it's going to be a pretty tough political situation for him to face.
And what about Donald Trump and the U.S.? What position are they in right now?
Well, I think President Trump has also staked quite a bit of political capital on making the negotiations work with North Korea. I think he will probably let his working level officials like Special Representative Biegun and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo drive the negotiations forward a little bit in the next several months and then see what they can produce before he is willing to meet with the North Korean leader again. But it doesn't look like the personal relationship between Trump and Kim has fallen apart yet, so I expect negotiations to continue.
Is the world in a more dangerous place than it was a month ago?
I don't think that the North Korean problem is going away anytime soon, and unfortunately that threat continues. They continue to work on their ballistic missile programs and their nuclear weapons programs. They haven't signed any agreement to make them stop that activity, so that threat will continue. I don't think it will be heightened anymore unless North Korea starts conducting nuclear weapons tests and ballistic missiles tests again in the near future, but we don't know if that will happen soon.
That's Lisa Collins, fellow with the Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. A U.S. journalist in Venezuela has been detained amid rising tensions. U.S. border policies are under fire in congressional hearings. A U.S. senator and Air Force vet says she was raped by an officer. And Mark Zuckerberg promises privacy-friendly Facebook, sort of. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, now the Democrats are in control of the U.S. House of Representatives. They're ramping up investigations of President Trump after accusing the formerly Republican-controlled chamber of refusing to provide oversight of what they call an investigation into the alleged corruption, obstruction, and other abuses of power by the president, his associates, and members of his administration. The president, though, lashing back at Democrats, saying it's all to gain political points ahead of the presidential election.
It's a disgrace to our country. I'm not surprised that it's happening. Basically, they've started the campaign.
The Trump administration is pushing back and showing it may not cooperate with the House Judiciary's committee that just requested documents this week from 81 people and associates linked to Trump. I talked about it earlier with Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University, and asked if Democrats are overreaching.
100 years ago or so, there were questions of the reach of Congress. And there were some courts that had held that when Congress demanded something, it had to be related to some legislative effort. That all has changed. The Supreme Court has held a number of times that Congress can take whatever information it can get, whatever information it wants, so long as privileges are not violated. For example, right to not be self-incriminating. And so I think from a legal standpoint, I think Congress is on solid ground in all the areas that it's looking at. It's looking at obtaining the president's tax returns. It's looking at some of the issues involving Russia. It wants to look at issues concerning his son-in-law's security clearance. So from a legal standpoint, I think the Hill is on solid ground. I think from a political standpoint, I think it's a much different picture. I think this is going to look like overreach. The White House already is using the victim game. This is harassment and so forth. And from a pure numbers standpoint, it certainly looks a lot like that. I think from a tactical standpoint, from a political relations standpoint, Congress would have been much better off doing this in sort of tranches, you know, of some number of requests this week and some number next week and so on, as opposed to this incredible demand.
My understanding is that some of the people they have sent the request to have responded positively and
sure,
are cooperating with them. I would imagine, though, that the president would push back. And does he have any ability to just flat out refuse? And then what happens?
Push back in the sense of saying, nope, I'm not giving this to you. And then what Congress needs to do is issue a subpoena. Now, each house has subpoena authority, so the House can certainly, I think, from a political standpoint, has the numbers to get a subpoena issued. And then the president can say, well, I'm still saying no, and then it goes to court. Now, I think the president, it'd be very hard for me to see what his argument would be other than executive privilege. There might be some of that, something to that in some issues. For example, the granting of the security clearance to his son-in-law. But his tax returns, I don't understand how that argument could possibly prevail.
Well, the other thing is that the heads of the House Intelligence, Foreign Affairs, and Oversight Committees made a joint request to the White House this week as well for records concerning communications between the president and Russian President Vladimir Putin, expressing concerns about allegations Trump worked to conceal details of the interactions. Does the president have any, wouldn't he just be able to consider that executive privilege?
Possibly. Courts generally, I think, are hostile to executive privilege claims. Courts don't view executive privilege claims terribly sympathetically.
Do you ultimately think that lawmakers will get the information that they want as to what transpired?
Yes, with a caveat. I think what he really wants to, the president really wants to, he and his advisors, is play out the game for time. Mm. There's an election coming in, a year and a half now. And, first you chat and stonewall, then, there's a subpoena, then you stonewall fight, go to court and so forth. Court, assume you lose in the lower court, then it goes to the Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court and so forth. That takes time. That could easily play out the clock. And then, of course, Mr. Trump would hope that a new Congress would be a Republican Congress rather than a Democratic Congress, and a new Congress coming in would simply end all of these investigations and cancel the subpoenas. So I think that I believe that a lawyer advising Mr. Trump would tell him that on the merits, the odds of his winning are small, but they might be able to play out the clock.
That's Robert Dyess, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. U.S. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen on Wednesday defended the government's position that the country faces a dire crisis due to migration at the U.S.-Mexico border in the face of fiery questioning from Democrats in Congress. Democrats questioned Nielsen over the Trump administration's zero-tolerance prosecution policy, which last year led to the separation of thousands of migrant children from their parents and generated a fierce backlash, as well as the administration's new restrictions on people seeking asylum at the border. The hearing had some tense moments like this one, with Nielsen being grilled by Democratic Representative Benny Thompson.
For the record, Madam Secretary, are we still using cages for children?
Sir, we don't use cages for children. In the border facilities that you've been to, they were not made to detain children. As the children are processed through, they are in subparts of those facilities.
Madam,
I don't,
Secretary?
I'm being as clear as I can, sir. Respectfully, I'm trying to answer your question.
Yes or no, are we still putting children in cages?
To my knowledge, CBP never purposely put a child in a cage, if you mean a cage like this.
Purposely or whatever, are we putting children in cages as of today?
Children are processed at the border facility stations that you've been at. Some of
the seen the cages. I just want you to admit that the cages exist.
Sir, they're not cages.
What are they?
Areas of the border facility that are carved out for the safety and protection of those who remain there while they're being processed. If we have two gangs, we separate them into separate areas of that facility.
No. Madam Secretary,
we separate that from another son.
We're not going to go through the semantics. Now, I saw the cyclone fences that were made as cages, and you did too. All you have to do is admit it. If it's a bad policy, then change it. But don't mislead the committee. Do not mislead the committee.
Nielsen also repeated previous calls for Congress to lift limits on how long families can be kept in immigration detention. The U.S. trade deficit hit a record last year, despite or rather because of actions to bring it down. AP correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
The U.S. trade deficit hit a 10-year high in 2018, in large part, says CFRA investment strategist Sam Stovall, because of the president's effort to drive it down with tariffs.
You had a lot of front-running by companies that wanted to buy in to foreign imports before the tariffs came into effect.
Trump entered office claiming the excess of imports over exports was a drain on the U.S. economy. The trend accelerated as American manufacturers stepped up imports to get ahead of tariffs. The U.S. had its biggest trade deficit with China, followed by Mexico. Warren Levinson, New York.
British police say a suspicious package destroyed by bomb disposal experts at the University of Glasgow on Wednesday contained an explosive device and was linked to three letter bombs sent to two London airports and a railway station. The mailing envelope sent to London's Heathrow Airport with one of the bombs inside partly caught fire when someone opened it, but no one was injured. The force urged transportation operators, mail sorting companies, and schools to be vigilant about watching for suspicious packages. I talked earlier to London-based reporter Amy Gutman and asked for the latest.
A suspicious package was found at the University of Glasgow on Wednesday. It's believed to be linked to explosive devices that were sent to three London transport hubs on Tuesday. Now, the key thing to point out here is that none of these devices were major terror threats. These were small IEDs, small explosive devices, and they've been carefully disposed of through controlled explosions carried out by army bomb disposal experts and other police experts. So no one has been injured. It's important to point that out.
But did they explode?
They were controlled explosions, only under very controlled circumstances with bomb disposal experts, and they were small devices. So what's unclear at the moment is what the motive here is. We don't know anything about the sender. What security sources believe is that there is a link between the suspicious package that was found at the University of Glasgow on Wednesday, along with the three small explosive devices that were sent to London transport hubs, that's Waterloo train station and buildings near Heathrow and London City Airport, on Tuesday. And the reason why they believe there's a connection is because the packages were very similar, the outside of these packages. They were packaged in similar ways. There were similar markings on the package. It could be that the handwriting was similar. They haven't gone into great detail. And what we know about the three London suspicious packages that arrived on Tuesday is that, curiously, they were posted with Irish stamps and had Dublin as the return address. But yet, security sources are also saying that just because they had these Irish markings doesn't necessarily mean that the sender had ideologies connected with Irish dissidents or with any Ireland-related terrorist groups. In fact, they're suggesting that this could be a deliberate attempt to make them appear as though there was an Irish connection when there may not have been.
I'm assuming this doesn't have anything to do with Brexit, right?
Well, one can make that assumption, but of course, the minute we read about a potential connection to Ireland, obviously people are wondering whether this is some kind of Irish dissident ideology regarding all the controversy related to Ireland specifically in the Brexit deal. But again, it's important to remember that security sources are stating that they're not convinced of the Irish connection. I think their position is, until they're clear who the sender is and what the motivation and the ideology is, they don't want to overstate things. It's also possible that there could be just some random person out there who's just incredibly annoyed or frustrated by the Brexit deal process, that they're doing this and again, deliberately trying to make it look like it's coming from Ireland, when in fact it may not be at all.
So do they think they are on to any solid leads as to who this person or who these people are that may be doing it?
Well, they haven't gone public with any leads they may have yet. But the important thing to note now is that because of Wednesday's discovery of the small explosive device at the University of Glasgow, and the links that they have seen in these markings, the similar markings in the packages between those that were sent to London transport hubs, you now have the Scottish police and the Metropolitan Police, that's the UK security forces, working in tandem together. And because of the Irish markings and the Irish postage stamps, you now also have the Irish police working in tandem. So you have these three separate police forces working quite closely together. So that's a fair bit of resource working to crack this.
Are there still concerns about a risk to the public and more of these showing up?
Well, luckily, there hasn't been any major risk to the public, and police have come out and said that they don't believe there is any real risk. And in fact, there were increased reports on Tuesday of suspicious packages all over London and the UK, many of which just turned out to be packages with promotional material or completely benign things. You know, maybe somebody left a bag behind, but at least it has raised the vigilance of the public, which is important.
All right. That's London-based reporter Amy Gutman. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. An environmental movement is growing across the globe and may soon spread to the United States. Kids and teenagers skipping class to raise awareness of climate change and protest government inaction. While many endorse their cause, their method is controversial. Should students skip school to strike for political issues? Marcus Meyer Galen explains.
Students skipping school to protest for climate action. This has been going on for months, mostly in Europe. Every Friday, tens of thousands of teenagers leave classrooms in Belgium, Germany, France, Australia, and other nations. Their dramatic message, why go to school if there is no future to live for? The movement started back in summer of 2018 with just one girl, then 15-year-old activist Greta Thunberg from Sweden. She refused to go to school on Fridays and instead sat in front of the Swedish parliament with a sign that read, "School Strike for Climate." Social media made her famous, and she soon gained a large following. Thunberg was invited to speak at the World Economic Forum in Davos.
I want you to panic. I want you to feel the fear I feel every day. And then I want you to act.
Thunberg's hashtags, School Strike for Climate and Fridays for Future, are now leading students out of classrooms to rally on the streets.
That's not democracy!
If governments don't do anything, the world will be a lot worse place because there'll be extreme storms, droughts, flooding, wars over natural resources, so there'll be a loss of stability across the world.
I skipped school today. Well, you can't even really say skipped because I think climate change is such a big deal that it should be okay to miss 2 hours of class for that.
The movement has picked up endorsements from German Chancellor Angela Merkel, British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, who said the students reminded him of himself as a young activist. Others have been less supportive. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison voiced his disapproval last November.
Kids should go to school. That's what we're committed to. We don't support the idea of kids not going to school. What we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
British Prime Minister Theresa May also voiced her concern that children waste valuable lesson time that would be important to help solve climate change and other problems. But Greta Thunberg tweeted back that politicians have already wasted 30 years without taking action. Some of the protesters addressed their criticism directly to May.
If the children do something, then Theresa May will notice. People say children can't do anything, but they can do something else.
The movement has been concentrated in Europe, but local groups are emerging elsewhere. Activists hope to spread the message in the United States on March 15th. That's when many groups have declared an International Strike Day. A move that may create even more controversy. Marcus Mayagian for VOA News Washington.
An HIV-positive man in Britain has become the second known adult worldwide to be cleared of the AIDS virus. At a conference in Seattle, the UN agency leading the global effort to end AIDS said it was greatly encouraged by the news. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Scientists have been searching for a cure for HIV/AIDS for close to 40 years. Those leading the fight against AIDS at the UN called the news that a British man has been functionally cured of HIV a breakthrough.
The breakthrough gives us great hope for the future, but also shows how far we are from the point of ending AIDS with science, as well as the absolute importance to continue to focus on HIV prevention and treatment efforts.
The London man is HIV-free after receiving a stem cell transplant from a donor with a rare genetic mutation, one that made him resistant to HIV. The patient is now off HIV treatment.
We waited 16 months before stopping in the post-transplant period just to make sure that the cancer was in remission, the patient was well, and that the measures we had of the HIV reservoir in the body showed that there was very, very little virus there, if any at all.
Gupta hesitates to call it a cure, but he says it's significant. This is the second patient to show no sign of the HIV virus after a similar stem cell transplant. The first was an American man treated in Berlin 12 years ago.
If you transplant those cells into somebody who already has HIV, you may protect those new cells from infection.
But stem cell treatment is not a practical cure for the 37 million people across the globe who have HIV. It's expensive, and finding a match with that genetic mutation is difficult. The procedure itself is painful and risky.
Having a bone marrow transplantation is a very complicated process. It requires an entire new set of cells to be taken into the person who's having the treatment. And that, again, is a process where whilst those cells are embedding, you're very at risk of getting infections and potentially dying.
Both the London and Berlin patients had cancer and had no other choice but to take that risk. The second success has fueled optimism.
We now have reason to believe that the Berlin patient was not a one-off case, meaning it is possible to nearly or maybe even completely eliminate HIV from the body of an infected person.
Scientists will continue to search for other ways to cure HIV, but now they know it can be cured, or at least put into remission. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come.
Well, on this day in music history, March 7th, 1985, the single We Are the World was released. The song, written by Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie, would move on to become the first single ever to gain quadruple platinum certification by the Recording Industry Association. The single was made specifically to bring charity donations for African famine relief and sold more than 20 million copies worldwide, topping the charts globally. It became the fastest-selling American pop single in history.
Family and the truth, you know, love is all we need. We are the world, we are the children, we are the ones who make a brighter day. So let's start here.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.